Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s New York Knicks. That book drops today. Chris Herring is my guest. Chris, good to have you back. How are you?
Jim, how are you, man? I'm doing great. I appreciate you having me on.
It's great to have you on. It's a big day for you. I know this. Now, you and I have talked about the book in the past, and I've been looking forward to it coming out, as I just mentioned. Before we get to the book itself, Spike Lee already got his copy, and he posted about it on social media, and then he called you to talk about it. I'm curious, what was that conversation like, and then what did that conversation mean to you personally?
I'm still not quite back on the ground yet. Still floating a little bit just from all that. Two-hour conversation with him the day after he read it. He read it the day he got it. He finished it that day. And the Knicks had a game that day, so he had other stuff he was doing. Just incredible. And he had all sorts of questions for me. He was like, how did you know this? He was intrigued by certain things, stuff that he didn't even necessarily know at some times that just surreal. I was sitting courtside with him yesterday. He's like, we've become best buddies since he read this book.
Wow.
It was just kind of incredible and not something that I pictured when I wrote this book at all.
Very cool. Very cool. So you start the book with Pat Riley, Xavier McDaniel, Anthony Mason, and the first practice of Riley's tenure as a Knick. What was that practice like, and what was the culture and the attitude that Riley was looking to develop?
I mean, it was just a blisteringly hot day inside of a gym that had no air conditioning, really. So, if you've ever played sports, there's always kind of that atmosphere that just makes it even more of kind of an agitating sort of feel. It was a fighting sort of day. And Riley had them working up a big sweat, had them running with their arms raised so that they wouldn't be able to breathe as freely because their abdomens are just kind of stretched straight up in the air. So people are already kind of in an agitated mood, and then they start doing a box out drill, which kind of invites guys to just rough each other up going for rebounds. And Xavier McDaniel essentially was tripping guys as they were on the way up for rebounds so that he could grab them instead. And Mason warned him once not to do it again. And the second time he did it, he said, okay, I warned you. And he just slugged Xavier McDaniel in the face. Xavier McDaniel is not a soft guy by any means, so he fought back. And so that was 15 minutes into the first practice with Riley as the Knicks coach. It immediately set a tone. And it was also a day where Pat Riley told them that was the tone he wanted them to have, is that he wanted them to be a fighting sort of team, that he wanted them to essentially try to take on what the Pistons had started as far as their physicality with the Bad Boys, that he felt like that was the best way for the Knicks to go forward, that they didn't have a Showtime sort of roster, obviously, and that he wanted them to he basically felt the Pistons were aging out, and the Knicks were the team that could kind of best fill that void to try to compete with the Bulls, who are going to be there every year.
Chris Herring is joining us. His new book, Blood in the Garden, the flagrant history of the 1990s New York Knicks, is out right now. Now, you want to talk about setting a tone. Early on his time, or in his time with the team, Riley fired a popular basketball operations employee. When he talked to the team about it, he said, quote, sometimes in a situation, you have to shoot a hostage in the head and then look around and say, who the bleep is next? End of quote. I mean, what an amazing story. What does that tell you about the way he was approaching the job?
I think he basically, everything about Riley, to a fault, I would say, and that comes up in the book multiple times, is that you're either in or you're out. And so I don't know, I've never really asked too many questions around why the person was let go, or even exactly the name of who it was. But the fact that he was so adamant about that, I think he was sending the message right there that, like, if you guys miss the person so much, then go be with them. You could be off the team too. That was essentially what he was saying. And he did that so many times and would test guys' loyalty so often. There's an anecdote that I've got later on in the book where he overhears Dave Checketts, the team president, talking with Checketts' wife on the phone. And she's out buying a family car, a Chevy Suburban, asking Dave Checketts, what color would you like? Are you okay with the color green, forest green? And Checketts says, fine, I'm fine with green. Riley can overhear it, and Riley tells him, no. Like, what? Are you kidding me? She can't get a green car, Dave. And Dave looks at him and says, why not? He says, because green represents the Celtics.
Right.
And obviously we know Riley's history with the Celtics from the Lakers. Checketts starts laughing, but Riley is completely serious. And then, so Checketts tells his wife, no, green won't work. What else they got? She says, okay, red. And Riley reacts even more strongly to that because he's like, we're in the Eastern Conference. Red represents the Bulls. Like, that's not going to fly. And so he's dead serious about that. So Checkitz tells his wife to just get a blue Suburban because that's all that Riley would be okay with. So that's the in-or-out mentality that I'm talking about. And it comes up several times in the book with Mason, even with Rolando Blackman in a moment that might have changed the course of history for the Knicks.
We're talking to Chris Herring. It's amazing. Now, I could follow you and ask you about the course of history changing issue that you mentioned with Blackman. That would be my job as the talk show host, but you said Mason first, and I'm always so intrigued and fascinated by all things Anthony Mason. There's so many great stories about him in the book, from the first practice to playing one-on-one with his junior high school age son. Which one, in your opinion, best sums up Mason's approach when it comes to basketball?
I do think that that's one of them, the one with the son, where it's just kind of take no prisoners, that you're not even going to let your son off the hook. His son's graduation day, you know, he's playing one-on-one with him, and he basically takes his son out of the sky with a clothesline. So that's one that stands out to me. Another one, really, is, you know, I kind of highlight a moment where he basically cusses out his college coach on senior night, and he does it because his mom was in town for the one and only time down at Tennessee State. She made the trip from New York. It was not a family that had much money. So it was a big deal for him to have her there. And he gets taken out of a game after making a really sloppy turnover on a play where he's trying to be fancy. He cusses the coach out. And, you know, okay, a lot of people cuss coaches out. But then I have an anecdote later in the book about him essentially issuing a death threat to Don Nelson after a game via a note that he left on Nelson's desk while he was talking to the media. So I think the idea of challenging Don Nelson and the idea behind the note was like, if you ever effing take me out of a game again, you know, essentially I'm going to kill you. And so he always had problems with being taken out of games. For the record, by the way, Don Nelson was playing Anthony Mason more than any player in the league that year. He led the league in minutes that year, and that was a death threat for saying, if you take me out, like, he wasn't taking you out for the most part. He played 38 minutes that night. But Mason was wound tight, was very emotional. He was very layered, too. I mean, there was a notorious side to him, obviously. I don't shy away from that in the book, but he had a sensitivity to him as well. He was just a really, to me, he was the most interesting player of that era. Riley was the most interesting person of that era with that team.
Really interesting. I loved talking to Mason back in the day, and you couldn't get him all the time, but if you can get him, I know exactly what you're talking about. He was so interesting. This book is called Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. The book is out right now. Chris Herring is the author. He is my guest. You know, there's so many iconic moments in that book. Let me ask you about the game where, obviously, in the playoffs, John Starks missed a potential game-winning shot. Starks gets off to a rough start in Game 7, and the question was, maybe you were talking about this, why Riley sticks with him instead of going with Rolando Blackman? How would you answer that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of the dilemma there, is that, look, Rolando Blackman didn't play at all in that series, so it's very easy to say that he just didn't play. Riley didn't see him as a good fit for that series. Some people would disagree with that. I thought it was very interesting that the Rockets that I interviewed for the book disagreed with that because they played against Rolando in that division when he was a member of the Mavericks several times. Rolando's best scoring average against any team came against the Rockets, so he's kind of a Rockets killer. And Scott Brooks in particular from the bench was saying, we were just praying he wouldn't bring Rolando in because we never had an answer for him. So the thing that the Knicks players told me, and Rolando said it as well, is that he had gotten into an argument with Pat Riley 2.5 weeks before Game 7, that he essentially asked, Pat, can we bring our wives to the finals? Because this is a crowning achievement for so many of us. We've never made it this far before. None of us have won a championship. It's been a long season. You know, keep in mind, the Knicks at that point had played the longest postseason in NBA history by the time they got to Game 7. They played 25 games in that postseason, which was the longest in history at that point. So Pat said no to Rolando's request. You know, Rolando was a respected veteran. He'd been an All-Star 4 times before. He would retire after that season. And so the players were kind of shocked at how short Riley was with his response to Rolando. And Rolando shot back, and he's like, I don't understand why we can't bring him. Why wouldn't we be able to? It's been a great season for us. They've held down our households in most cases. You know, we never asked for them to be able to travel anywhere else, but this is different. Can they come? And Riley again said no. And he could tell that you could tell that Riley was frustrated by him even asking the question again in front of the group. And so some people, there are at least 3 or 4 of them, a couple of people kind of sent me off to a dock, and Derek Harper both kind of said, you're going to have to ask Rolando exactly what happened, but he's got reason to be upset with Pat to this day, as far as they were concerned. So the players have wondered for a while whether Pat took that out on him by not using him in a Game 7 situation. And I don't think that's the whole reason. I mean, Starks had been on fire that series. He had shot basically 50%, 45% from three from games 2 to 6. So it's feasible that, you know, he had had double-digit fourth quarters in games 4, 5, and 6. It's completely feasible that Pat just thought that John was his best option. But even if you were going to put Rolando or somebody else in for 2, 3 minutes, just to give John a breather to let him compose himself when he's missed so many shots in a row, all of 11 from three, it's feasible that he could have gone to Rolando and just didn't because he was frustrated with him. And some of the Knicks players do believe that that was the case.
Amazing. Chris Herring joining us. So, Chris, at one point, Riley had the team, and I'm just kind of bouncing around a little bit right here, but Riley had a team playing reroute to Reno, and he gave them $10,000 to gamble with. How did that go down with the players, and then what was the fallout from that move between Riley and the organization?
Sure. Well, he did it thinking that, you know, they had been in a four-game rut. They'd lost four games in a row. Their offense was just horrible, even by their standards, which they didn't have a great offense to begin with. So they were about to go to Sacramento, I believe, and right as the plane was taking off, Riley essentially sent his secretary, team secretary, traveling secretary, to go up to the pilot and ask if they could reroute the plane somewhere else. And they were trying to figure out where it would have a long enough runway for them to do it, and picked Reno because he wanted for them to be able to just gamble and kind of let their hair down a little bit to get their mind off of the losing streak. Because Pat, in his mind, you always push harder. You practice harder until you get it right. So this was an instance where he couldn't really fathom pushing them any harder than he already had. So they go gambling. He pulls $10,000 of his own money out of his pocket to put forward for chips, $500 for each player. And Starks goes through his allotment right away. He burns through all $500 of it right away. But he was about to kind of change the starting lineup. He was about to pull three of his starters and put them on the bench, and then put three guys from his bench into the starting lineup, including Starks and Charles Smith, who were his number two and number three scorers on that team. So it was a big shift to be doing that, and he does it. But the Knicks go from a four-game losing streak to immediately winning that game in Sacramento and each of the next 14 after. So they went on a 15-game winning streak. The irony, though, as you ask that, is that it might have played some role in sort of unraveling Pat's relationship with the Knicks, though, because, again, he was completely in or out. But the team never really paid him back the $10,000. He wanted to be reimbursed, basically, for something that turned the team around. And they said, yeah, that's fine. We can understand that. We'll pay you back. They never got around to doing it because they couldn't figure out. The excuse I got was that they couldn't figure out how to expense it for a publicly traded company that had a bunch of shareholders. Like, how do you explain $10,000 worth of gambling money for millionaires? Was kind of the way that they were framing that. And Pat got extremely frustrated about it. And he actually raised it with the person that would become the owner of the team a few months later. So it was very strange, but he, you know, I was told that he essentially never got over that. The Knicks have told me that he essentially never got over that slight never being paid back. He was very much a nickel and dime guy for how wealthy he was.
I was going to say, Chris, I don't know what's more unbelievable to me, that the team would risk alienating a legend like that over $10,000, or that a guy like that would be that upset over $10,000.
He had a $300 per day request for per diem. Now, he asked Mickey Arison, or at least he had his arranger ask Mickey Arison for $50 million over 10 years. That was what he wanted in addition to the ownership stake and everything else. But he, within that, and then Mickey Arison actually called this out when he was looking at Riley's contract demands, he wanted a $300 per day per diem, despite the fact that Mickey Arison was buying his home in Los Angeles and New York, despite the fact that he was essentially signing off 20% of ownership, 10% immediately and 10% in the future, despite the fact that he was asking Mickey Arison for a loan to cover the taxes he was going to have to pay on the ownership stake, he asked for a $300 per day per diem.
Insane.
And Mickey Arison said, how the hell are you asking me that when I'm already doing all this other stuff for you? Credit cards, a limo to and from every game. But that's how Pat was. He also asked for the Knicks to cover his dry cleaning. When he took the job there, they said no to that. But, I mean, he was someone, he didn't grow up wealthy at all. And so he was someone that, that you know, was going to kind of take everything that he could get. And he didn't stop trying to do that when he was leaving the Knicks or when he was joining Miami.
And we could do this for hours and hours and hours, and I'm already in much longer than I need to be, but I have to ask you one last thing. Patrick Ewing? Like, he had his relationship with his teammates, but I'm really curious about his relationship with the Knicks fans, because he was the only superstar for years with the Knicks, but you'd be hard-pressed to say that he was a fan favorite. Why was that, and is it something that bothered him?
Yeah, no, it absolutely bothered him. I tried to get into it a little bit towards, he was one of the last chapters in the book, which normally you write about the superstar early. I thought he was in more of a transformational period towards the end of his career, in part because of the relationship with the fans and the fact that he felt like he was kind of underappreciated. The fact that really Starks, Mason, and Oakley, and multiple people told me this, you almost kind of get the impression that fans, the way fans love them, you would have thought their numbers were in the rafters. When in reality, Ewing is the only guy that that's true of. Every one of those other guys, they'll wore their heart on their sleeve. Oakley was diving into the stands every night. Starks, was wildly emotional for good and bad. Mason was wired the same way, hearts on their sleeves. Ewing was kind of more to himself. Some of that was by design with the media. And some of it was just kind of the way he was raised and the way he came up. So I think that was a big, big part of it. I mean, the thing was, he put in the sweat equity maybe more than anybody. He played through all sorts of injuries. He was, wearing all of the weight on his shoulders from a scoring standpoint, from being the franchise star for essentially 15 years, the first six of which he had, six coaches and four general managers, which is why he wanted to leave the Knicks before Pat Riley got there. So I just think he didn't really have the ability to show some of that emotion the way that those other guys did. And you did get the impression that he wasn't the most popular. Everyone knew he was the best player, but he wasn't the most popular player with the fans. Oakley, Starks, and Mason kind of seemed to maybe take that cake. And it definitely seemed to wear on him, especially when talk radio was really coming into play during some of those years. And it was just a conversation piece for people to be able to bring up all the time.
Now, this book is out today, and this is why we've been talking about this book for several months leading up to today. The book is called Blood in the Garden, The Flagrant History of the 1990s New York Knicks. It is now out. He is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, co-host of Open Floor SI's NBA show, Chris Herring. Chris, congratulations. The book is absolutely amazing. Great to have you on the show. Very well done. I could listen to that all day. You and I could talk for several more hours. In fact, from me to you, that will not be our last conversation about that book. Thank you so much for that. And again, congrats.
Thanks so much, Jim. I really appreciate you.
Appreciate you too, Chris, very much. Really well done. Tremendous book. Amazing book. And I could do that for hours. There's so many good things. There are so many stories and anecdotes from that book that I could never even get to in one interview like that. So let's break, because I ran long, but that is a really amazing book. You should get that right away.